It's Radio Free 501c, the podcast of Rogue Tulips Consulting. I'm your host, Cecilia Sopp, and we're so excited to be back for Season 6 and continue bringing you outstanding ideas and thought leaders and different ways of thinking. So don't forget to subscribe because you're not going to want to miss any of it. This week on Radio Free 501c, I welcome first-time guest Khan Vu as we continue our celebration of Asian American Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Month. It's May 6th, and we're talking about the leadership journey of Khan Vu. Welcome to episode 239. Hey everybody, it's Monday, May 6th, and that means it's time for another episode of Radio Free 501c, brought to you by Rogue Tulips Consulting. Hello, I'm your host, Cecilia Sopp. I'm the principal and founder of Rogue Tulips, and to our global audience, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you may be, and thanks to everybody for joining us. This month, it's May, the lovely month of May, as they sang in Camelot, and that means it's Asian American Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander Month, or AANHPI Month. And Radio Free 501c and Rogue Tulips were invited by the ASAE AANHPI group to participate in celebrating and recognizing people from this community who contribute so much to the nonprofit management profession. I'm so pleased to welcome Khan Vu to our second episode honoring AANHPI month, and he is going to introduce himself in a moment, but I wanted to share our topic, the leadership journey of Khan Vu. We are all shaped by our personal experiences, and sometimes we see each other and we don't realize where we started because we only see where we ended up at this point in time. So Khan is going to talk with us about that and how his early life experiences shaped his leadership journey. But Khan, before we do that, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you here. Would you like to say hello to our audience and tell us a little about yourself?
First of all, Cecilia, thank you for having me on. And thank you for highlighting AANHPI month. I think not a lot of people know. And so, you know, your audience now knows. So hi, everyone. My name is Khan Vu. I am the CEO and Executive Director for the Society of Asian Scientists and Engineers, pronounced SACE for short, like vase. Some people might call us SASE, but we're really SACE. We might be sassy sometimes. But yeah, no, thank you for having me on. You know, you and I just talked before the broadcast that it's, you know, just this last week was April 30th, which is the 49th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. And why that is important, particularly for me, is that's when I left Vietnam and made my journey to the United States, unbeknownst to me at the age of 5. So, and it's been a wild ride since that time. And now I am leading one of the largest Asian American nonprofits in the United States and really enjoying this ride so far.
Well, and I think that it's important for our audience, Khan, if you could tell us a little more about SACE and what you do to help your members and people in this community.
Thank you. The SACE community is made up of many college students. So we have almost 100 SACE chapters across the United States in many of the engineering and science colleges across the United States. We have one in Canada, so we're technically international. So we will grow our Canadian presence more in the future. And then we started our journey with professionals, Asian professionals, about 4 years ago. We've been talking about it. What we figured out is there are challenges for Asian professionals. Even though I don't like the word, we're, quote, overrepresentative relative to our general population. So there's about, you know, 7% plus of the U.S. general populations who are AANHPI folks, but they are, depending on the industry, anywhere from 12 to 20, 25% of working professionals who are of Asian heritage in the professional world. And so when you look at that, we're overrepresented. However, the challenge is if you look at how many people start with a company who identify as that heritage and how many make it to the C-suite, that drop off is drastic. And in particular, female Asians, AHPI folks, have a harder time. If you cross-reference any gender and ethnicity, Asian females are less likely to be promoted into leadership position, management position, and C-suite than any other of those combinations. So we're trying to tra tackle that on many different areas through programming, through conferences. But yeah, we try to service the what we call the life cycle of the Asian STEM folks. And leadership is not just for STEM, of course, it's for everyone. But our focus is more of a cultural leadership because the leadership style of the United States, if you look at the history, mostly British based. You know, if you look at the British Parliament, what do? They stand up and they shout at each other. They try to be really witty. You know, they're verbal jabs. They're jousting verbally. Where if you look at the Asian culture, there's not a lot of verbal jabbing. There's a lot of authority. There's a lot of power distance, as we call it. You know, the boss is usually quote unquote correct, and you follow what the boss says. You don't challenge the boss. So there's a lot of nuance in leadership when you talk about Asian leadership, culturally speaking, and the United States leadership, which is European and British based mostly.
Yes, that's really interesting. I've never been, well, I guess maybe I've been to Asia. I've been to Japan once, to Tokyo. So I don't know if everybody considers Japan Asia, although the people are of Asian descent, but they are their own island archipelago. So but I've always kind of thought of the difference between Western society and civilization and Asian society and civilization as in the West, we're more individual driven, which leads us to the British Parliament yelling at each other because they're trying to make their point. And then in Asia, more of that group society, the what's best for the group. And I am distressed to hear that Asian women seem to have more difficulty getting into C-suite positions. Do you think that is a woman issue, or do you think that is because, some people do think Asian Americans are overrepresented in certain areas?
Yeah, you've opened up Pandora's box, honestly.
Uh-oh.
We could spend
Sorry.
the whole episode talking about this. I think a couple of things happens. We are very familiar with the glass. I think everybody accepts that, understands that, and knows what the glass ceiling is. There's a term my friend Jane Hun started. It's called the bamboo ceiling, right? And what it is talking about the ceiling for Asian Americans because of these cultural differences. To your point, Cecilia. There is this kind of individual index. So there was a gentleman who worked for IBM in the 60s and 70s, Hofstede. And he, at the time, IBM was it. Big Blue was it. They were the tech company, and they had offices in almost every country in the world. And so they do an annual survey. And what he did was he took that annual survey and looked at the differences between the countries. So he came up with this six-dimensional theory. So he has a cultural dimensional theory he talks about. One of them is individual and where the United States rank on it. So if you look at the, I think if I remember correctly, the United States ranks very high, 70 or 80 quote out of 100 in that individual ranking, where Vietnam and maybe some of the other Asian, East Asian culture ranks a lot lower. You know, Japan or maybe China would rank like in the 30s to 40. So there is a concept of difference in how we think about the individual. Is it emphasized or de-emphasized? So one of my friends, Dennis Hirotsu, retired senior vice president of Procter & Gamble. He worked in Japan, and he's fourth generation Japanese. And he said, you know, at P&G corporately, very individualistic, but very, you know, focused on the company. But when he went to Japan working for P&G, he had people carry his, you know, suitcase when he landed because that's how they are. The boss is seen as the boss, and when you tell them to do something, they usually say, "How high do I jump?" They don't ask you why I jump, because in the United States, they're like, "Why am I jumping? Can you tell
That's
me
right.
why am I jumping?" But no, in Japan, the expectation is that I will do it now, and I will jump very high.
Oh
That's
my
it.
God.
Yeah. And so there is definitely, culturally speaking, even for a fourth generation Japanese, he tells me this story about he's the youngest of four brothers, right? Senior vice president of Procter and Gamble. When he comes home, he says what he's been trained to say. His older brother looks at him and go, "Who made you king? You're the youngest brother. I'm the older brother. You
Okay,
know, my
now.
opinion matters more," right? And so there's this definitely hierarchy of authority too, which is another dimension on this Hofstede's cultural dimensional theory. So that's one aspect. I think the other thing is how Asian women are portrayed in movies for the longest time. Very misogynistic, very subservient. You see them wearing kimonos or they're playing prostitutes or whatever, right? The Broadway play Miss Saigon.
Right.
And so you have all of these kind of connotation of what an Asian woman should be acting like. And so beyond the glass ceiling, beyond the bamboo ceiling, you have this misogynization of Asian women, right? And so that's why some of those, this is our belief, that Asian women aren't being promoted. The data shows that. So I think that's the challenge there, is that overcoming those unconscious bias, understanding cultural differences between the leadership style, and also understanding that women in general in the Western society are not seen as leaders. I think it's changing. I think it's changing for the better, but I think there's still, based on the data, there's still a lot of long way to go.
And I would agree with that. And that could be a whole other episode of this podcast is talking about women's issues, because you are absolutely right about the way Asian women are portrayed in media, especially movies and television series. I've been watching a few recently and I'm like, wow, they're Asian characters, but what the women have to do to have any power just over their own life is demeaning on too many levels. But hey, that's something we need to change for everybody, I think. Not just Asian women, all women, and then respecting women as leaders. And that, again, a whole other topic for another episode. But I want to talk a little bit more about, thank you for that. I want to talk a little bit more about your personal leadership journey, Khan. And you and your family had to flee your home country when you were only 5 years old, and you may not have a lot of memories of that, but how did that shape your worldview as you started to grow and then grow into a leadership position?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about wars and it's personal to me. My dad was a high school principal. He's a brilliant man. The test that they used to take in Vietnam was under the French system. So it's like a baccalaureate, right? Every high schooler had to take this exam, the baccalaureate, to see how well they ranked. And then that determines what college you can get to. The year that my dad took it, he ranked second in the nation. Second in the nation. The guy who beat him had a private tutor, came from a wealthy family. He lost his mom very young, and he was poor. He started working when he was 6 years old. He had to study on his own, couldn't afford more than two shirts going to school. So he's a brilliant, brilliant man. Unfortunately, I didn't inherit a lot of that brilliance. My sister did. She's the John Hopkins UPenn doctor. So I got the leftover. No, I'm just
I'm sure there was enough to go around.
There was. We all have our own ways. So because he worked as a high school principal, he was considered part of the government, right? And when the South government collapsed, anybody who worked for the government would have to go to hard labor camp. Basically, not quite a concentration camp, but hard labor camp. The purpose there is to work you until you died in the camp. My father-in-law was, I believe he was a lieutenant colonel in the Navy, very high up. He spent 10 years in hard labor. Over half of the people who came in died. He was one of the lucky ones. And to this day, he doesn't talk about it much. And I think that's the challenge, is there are things that when you go through such trauma, you don't talk. And as children, how do we deal with it? And I have flashbacks of places I'll describe to my parents. It's like, oh, I can see this place. What is it? And they'll say, oh, that's your grandfather's house. That's, this is where you went to the market, all this stuff. But I don't have context because I'm so young. But those traumas, one of my friends, Amy, talks about intergenerational trauma. Things that happened to my parents. I was there, but I was young. I still feel it. I think as growing up, somebody who came to the United States, who lost everything, who started in government housing, the SNAP program or the food stamps, as we used to call them. We only had eat chicken twice a month because we couldn't afford meat, and that's all we could afford was twice a month. I mean, it's one of those things that I'm very thrifty when it comes to running an association. So great for a startup mentality, right? Trying to get things to manage. But so there's so much nuance in how we struggled, how as the first English speaker of the family, I had to translate for my parents. I was basically, I'm the oldest of six kids, so I was quote unquote the parent for my five siblings, because I went to the PTA meeting, I signed their forms because my parents knew English, but they didn't know anything about what is this after school activity. They didn't know, and they're like, why should we let our kid go to after school activity or this extracurricular stuff? So there was a lot of burden on the oldest, especially coming from a large family and immigrant family, but that we had to navigate that typical kids don't. So I have an appreciation for those who are struggling, and thus, led me to the path of where I am today. But I mean, again, there's a whole unpacking of immigration and immigrant kids and what it's like to, eat powdered eggs. I will never, ever eat powdered eggs again. I'm sorry.
No, I
It's
don't
the
blame
nastiest thing in the world. I still can taste it on my tongue to this day. And that's when I was 5 or 6. And so that's why I'm a foodie, because I'll
Oh,
be,
good for you.
I
Yeah,
will
so
never eat
you
powdered
grow
eggs
up.
again.
Yeah.
They are the nastiest thing in the world. But I
Oh my.
mean, we were lucky to be in the United States,
You're
even
making
though,
me flashback to powdered milk.
yes, we had that too.
Yeah, I'm just, oh, you know, we had, yeah. I drink almond milk now.
The
I don't
privilege of
drink
drinking
powdered milk.
milk.
Yeah, it's, you get to choose. It's like that's one of the funny things I say about being a grown up is, you know, if you want to eat Cap'n Crunch cereal, you can because you're a
Yes.
grown up now. So we get to make those choices. But we did not immigrate here. I grew up in the United States, but you know, my family was lower working class when I was very young. And so, and there were seven of us, seven kids in my family. I'm one of the younger ones. So there was some struggle to make the money stretch. So again, not the same level as somebody who's just coming to the United States. I mean, that must have been terrifying, though. I mean, you're 5 years old, the world you knew is gone. You are brought to the United States to a place you've never been before. And then you have to try to figure out what's next. So what were some of the, I mean, and you said you were the parent in a lot of ways for your younger brothers and sisters, being an English speaker, so you're bilingual. So you're able to communicate on behalf of the family and also explain to your parents what an after school event was or activity, and then help like with parent teacher meetings and things like that. So that's leadership already, even though you may not have thought of it in that context. So how, what leadership lessons did you bring forward from helping your family navigate when you got a little older, and how did that influence how you're a leader now?
That's a great question. I haven't really thought it in that way, but I guess we talked a little bit, and I shared that one of my superpowers is community building, right? And nurturing. In community building, you want to nurture people, you want to build them up, and I think it's great for a startup because you have volunteers and you nurture them up. We've been very successful. Now we're kind of maturing in our life cycle as a nonprofit. So what I call it, we're in our teen years, the awkward years, where we're, we have staff, we have volunteers, now we're hiring consultants to see how to help us grow. But I think my superpower is still community building. It's that nurturing, caring for my siblings. It's about bridging the gap between people, between my parents and other folks. There's a distinct memory that I still have when I was in first grade, one day when they called me to the principal's office. When you called to get the principal office, you're like, oh, what did I do?
Right.
What happened was that there was a second grader that was crying really hard, and no one could speak to her because she just came over and she didn't know English, and no one on the staff spoke Vietnamese. This was early on in the, I believe, 1977, 76 time frame. And so they brought me because I was one of the students who actually knew Vietnamese and had enough English at the time that I could communicate. And the kid was bawling her eyes off, and no one knows how to help her. So they called me up to the principal's office and say, "Hey, can you talk to her?" And I talked to her, and she lost her mom and dad, and she was in a new environment. She was freaking out, and I tried to comfort her as much as I could. And that's when I found, kind of my superpower is like, I'm a bridge. I'm a scientist. I mean, I'm an engineer. I love math. I'm a math geek, but yet I also love dealing with people, even though they can be annoying and stressful sometimes, but it takes the patience and looking at the best of people and finding that, unpolished gem and bringing that out is where I get my joy, right? And you need patience and you need a lot of curiosity. And so it was taught to me early on that I could be a bridge community leader, bringing people together. And so, yeah, that's a great question. I haven't thought it in that way. I guess I do derive some of that from the early years where I did bridge those gaps, those areas between the different communities, the new immigrant who no one at the time spoke Vietnamese, and then the American speaking system, right? Whether it's for my parents, whether it's for my siblings, whether it's for a second grader crying her eyes out. I still do it to this day. I still bridge a lot of those communities, whether it's for the nonprofit. We were just talking about that. You're in a consulting area, and I was like, hey, all the CEOs are always looking for consultants to do certain things. Why can't there's an easier way to bridge that community? So I'm always looking in with that lens.
Well, and I really appreciate that because I also try to connect people. And I think the problem sometimes in a large organization like ASAE, for example, is we tend to kind of silo, not purposely or thoughtfully, but it just kind of happens. And so finding someone like yourself is like, hey, why don't the consultants just tell us more about what they do? It's like, oh, duh, that just totally makes sense, because we've been rebuilding our consultant community over the last, I'd say, year and a half, and we've been doing a really good job of it. So just those opportunities to be that person to say, hey, let's start making things better. Let's talk to each other, let's communicate, let's come together. And I think that's a lot of what leadership is building community and letting people have those relationships and then getting out of the way of the relationships and letting them go. You described yourself as a bridge, and I think that, first of all, with your experience moving from one country to another, so you moved from Vietnam to the United States, which is like completely different from Vietnam. Just the way, not just language, but culture and landscape and how we do things, and it's a little kind of crazy in the United States sometimes. So coming into that as a child and then learning a new language and then being the interpreter basically for your family until they got some English under their belt and they could then talk. It just really, a lot of it is language and understanding each other. So I think that's really a wonderful message. I'm just kind of bubbling up right now. Sorry, I'm bubbling up because it really is what we can do to just help each other, talk to each other, learn about each other, and come together and help each other be a bridge for each other to different areas. Sometimes we need a bridge, but sometimes we can be a bridge. And I really like that. So now you keep referring to SACE as being like a newer kind of group. So are you the first CEO of SACE?
Yeah, so there's a misconception since I've been with SACE for such a long time. So I have to peel it back before we started. So I was working at my alma mater, Carroll School of Mines, as the Multicultural Engineering Program Director, MEP for short. And there, when I was a student way back when, I won't date myself, but you can do the math with the whole immigration thing. I was the one of the very first student in the very first class to graduate from that program, and so I have an affinity for that program. And so when I came back to be the director, I started also the Asian Student Association. The Asian Student Association was just a singular association within the Colorado School of Mines. When I came back as the director, umpteen years later, we thought, well, there's the Society of Women Engineers that was founded, 70 years ago, National Society of Black Engineers that was founded 50 plus years ago, the Society of Hispanic Professional Engineers that was founded almost 50 years ago. So where's one for the Asian folks? And there wasn't one. So at Mines and with some other Colorado universities, we started the Professional Asian Society of Engineers and Scientists. Because as young folks, we Googled what SAIS was. And at SAIS at that time, first thing that popped up was self-addressed stamp envelopes. Thank
Yes.
goodness the self-addressed stamp envelope is not a real thing anymore.
Oh my gosh, that's right. I totally forgot.
I know, right? It dates ourselves. And so we called ourselves PACES instead, right? We came up with other funny acronyms. We could call ourselves ASSES, but that's probably not
Probably
a
not
acronym.
a
So we tried the different combinations and we came up with PACES. So
good
we
thing.
formed in the exact same year at SAIS. Probably my friend, one of my students, Ricky, would say we were formed a little bit earlier than SAIS. So PACES, we found out that SAIS exists. And as I mentioned to you, I'm a community builder, right? So I tell people in the story is that I'm a lover, not a fighter, right? Our mission were exactly the same. Why do we have to fight over our slice of the pie? Let's fight for the bigger part of the pie and let's combine source, combine forces. So, we had a meeting with SAIS and I said, PACES will join you. We'll get rid of the name. And I became a volunteer. So I was one of the first seven volunteers for SAIS back in 2010. And we spun it off. And then when they had enough money to hire the first executive director, they hired a retired P&G, John Chang, to kind of transition us. But I was the first full-time permanent executive director for SAIS. And the rest is history. We were a one-person band, and now we're 12 plus and growing. We've been growing basically one paid staff a year that we've hired since then. And I think we're going to hit our, as they call, exponential growth in the S curve of growth here coming up because people are starting to find out about SAIS. They love what we do. We have an NPS, what they call a net promoter score. Usually our programs, especially our professional programs, run, 8.5 to 9.7. I think our last one last Friday came in total as a 9.7, which is amazing if you know anything about NPS scores. And then we have this hashtag called SAISFAM among our collegiate folks where their affinity to SAIS is super strong. I always say that even though we don't charge for membership and anybody can join, we don't check your ethnicity, we don't check your major, we don't check what profession you are. You can join SAIS for free. Because I've always thought about our community. I think back to the day when I came to the United States is, free was good for immigrants like myself. And I don't want us to be a barrier for someone who wants to join us. But I think that, I tell folks jokingly that we accept everybody except for vampires and zombies. We get So you're welcome to join SAIS. It's on our website. It's easy to sign up. You can follow us on LinkedIn. All our professional stuff is there. But yeah, it's just an interesting journey of what SAIS does and how we help our community and realize that, yes, we do index very high and we studied very well and our GPA is amazing and our career fair has some of the brightest folks you'll ever. I always tell folks that I wasn't as studious in college as I was in high school, so I probably would not have made the cutoff for our SAIS core group right now, because average GPAs runs 3.5. 90% of our folks are 3.0 or better. Granted, there's great inflation in these past few decades that happens, but still, very, very bright folks, and I love working with them.
Well, I just love your approach to having no dues. That's a thing that I realized years ago. Dues are a barrier, especially when you're first starting out. And so they either need to be so low that you can easily pay them out of pocket, or you need to get a lot of stuff with it. I think there's it kind of segueing over to dues for a second. I think there's too many organizations that still charge hundreds of dollars just to join. And then you still got to pay for everything. And it's like, well, what am I getting for this other than access? It's like Costco, I got to pay to go shopping so I can spend money. That doesn't make any sense to me. I can just go to the grocery store and buy a bunch of stuff. But that's again, that would be a great topic to have you back to talk about too, because it seems like if you're adding a paid staff person every year for 12 years, that whatever you're doing is working. So that's a model that I think other people should know a little bit more about.
Yeah, but I think if you truly analyze how much you spend on your dues, general, keeping a database of folks who paid, who hasn't, figuring out the benefits ratio and maintaining all that and how much you bring in dues, unless you're charging, unless there's an exclusivity, right? I always say, the American Chemical Society owns the material database. So if you want to work with any materials, you have to subscribe. If you have that type of, monopoly over that information, you can charge whatever you want. If you don't, right, and you want people to connect with you, why are you charging something that's actually costing you more to maintain than that? And so one of my mentors, Betty Shanahan, the previous executive director for Society of Women Engineers, she said this to me, and I always think about this every time we do something, is what kind of barriers are you putting up from allowing people to come to you, and be very thoughtful. There's reasons why you want to put barriers up sometimes, right? But be very thoughtful and mindful of how you put those barriers up and who you're trying to attract. I think that we don't think about that enough as a nonprofit in general. And most people, again, if you ask them if you could go to non-dues, most people would choose to go to non-dues because they say a legacy. And it takes courage, right? If you've been around for a while and you've had dues and you have some people who've been paying dues for a long time, they're like, I want my dues. I want to feel special, right? But realistically, on a financial impact and also from the future thinking, to me, it's like the cable. You have an old model, the cable cutting. Everybody's cutting their cable because you're paying for one. Supposedly you're getting 2,000 channels, but you're really using channels, five, six. At the end of the day, is it worth it to pay X amount of dollars to maintain all those channels? So I think a lot of nonprofits need to assess and look deep down, is dues really beneficial and what does it really do for you? I would challenge, I'm not saying everybody should go to a non-due kind of model, but I would challenge a lot of the non, I've heard enough chatter in the last decade or so that I think a lot of folks need to reassess because they're not attracting the college students, they're not attracting the young professionals that are making that transition. And so I think if you really want to attract those two populations, you really need to think about non-due as an opportunity.
Well, or they need to be so low that it's easily affordable, like
Yeah,
$10
agree.
a month or something like that. That's like a quick lunch or two cups of coffee,
Yeah.
depending, where you're going or if you're having a coffee drink. But I've written more than several blog articles on that very topic about what are dues getting us. Our model is old. Our model's
Yes.
from the 19th century. But a lot of us don't know the history of our own profession and why we keep doing these things. It just keeps getting passed on. So, if we're mentoring the next generations, are we giving them what they need to succeed in a different environment? And I think that's something we're not really paying attention to. And I also have written a blog post about, is a certain organization too much like cable TV? Because there's so many different groups now representing, smaller segments of our nonprofit management community. And that's fine, but a lot of them now are going off in their own direction. And how much time and money do we have? And so you need to pick. So is it Apple Plus and Hulu, or is it Netflix and cable?
Max, HBO Max, Prime Video, you name it.
Oh yeah, I got that too. So it's but this has been a wonderful conversation. I'm so glad that Joanna Panita of Matrix Group connected us. Shout out to Joanna, our friend. This has been a wonderful conversation. I would love to have you back to dive into some of these other topics if you're interested.
Oh, again, thank you very much, Cecilia, for having me here and, highlighting ANHPI month. I think it's important. We do make only 7% of the general population, but it's the largest growing segment of the US population, and there's so much that we bring to the table to enhance the tapestry of the United States, right? The mosaic of the United States. And I think that the United States, to continue to be the great nation that it is, needs to lean in on, the ANHPI community and all that we bring to the table. And so I welcome, you having highlighted all these great leaders within our community. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I'm glad to do it because, as a student of history and just people in general, everyone has something to offer. And I also know that people from Asia and the Pacific Islands have really contributed a lot to what is now the United States. It wasn't just people from Europe. So people from all over the world have come here and made it their own. And I'm a big believer in that. So that's one of the things my parents taught me is anyone can become an American. You can come here and make a life and be part of this country. But I think we all need to be aware that there are societal tensions always in any country. But let's try to set those tensions aside by getting to know each other. That's the only way to do it. So I want to thank you again, Khan, for sharing your very personal story of how you came to the United States with your family, and so glad you are part of our profession.
I just happen to be here. I've been an engineer. I've been in higher education. I've been retail. I have a real estate license, and I was semi-retired for a little bit of time. That's a whole different story. And I was in retail. So yeah, I follow my passion, follow where it leads me, and I'm lucky and privileged enough that I have a support system that allows me to do that. Particularly I tell my people that I am a trophy husband because my wife works for AWS. And she's the breadwinner of the family. And so anytime I get to showcase and support her, I'm happy to. But yeah, she really lets me be who I am. And I'm truly grateful for that. Sheryl Sandberg says the most important business decision that you can ever make is who you decide to have as a partner. And I 100% agree with that. But again, thank you for this opportunity. And yeah, definitely coming back for all the other stuff that we talked about.
Oh my gosh, so many topics. So so little time. So, well, this has been great. So, Khan, I always like to ask my guest, what is the one thought? I know we've had many thoughts in our rather short conversation, considering how many things we touched on. But what is the one thought you would like the audience to take away today? And if they want to get in touch with you and learn more or just talk with you some more, how could they get in touch?
Yeah, great question. I think one thing I've learned recently through executive coaching, I would say, is one of the five behaviors, famous book about building teams, is lead with curiosity. Really lead with curiosity. You're going to make assumptions. That's what we do as human beings. But before you jump to that and finalize that conclusion about topic, someone, some ideas, ask that one question that will open up maybe your eyes or your assumptions or challenge your thinking. And I think that's where innovation starts. That's where bridge building starts. That's where a lot of things start. So lead with curiosity. And that's why I've been able to change careers and industry because I've led with curiosity and I asked a lot of questions. So that's my one word of advice to folks. And yeah, I'm active on LinkedIn. Please add me to your LinkedIn. It's VQ, it's my last name, middle initial, and it's pretty simple. Or you can look up, say, Society of Asian Scientists and Engineers. I'm active on there, so if I see you and you're liking a lot of our posts, you'll probably see me commenting on some of those things. So again, much appreciated to this audience for tuning in.
That's great. Well, and I also encourage everyone to keep an eye out for other activities coming from the ASAE AANHPI community, including some activities on LinkedIn. I believe you're launching your own LinkedIn group in May, correct?
Yeah, thanks to Kristen. She's charged of creating that group and putting a lot of our activities on there. And thank you to ASAE for really encouraging, because I avoided ASAE, to your point, because it was such a behemoth. So I belong to CESS and I'm on the CESS board, which was a subset of really, well, it's not that small anymore. It's 200 STEM associations and nonprofits that belong to that. So I work in that community quite a bit and avoided ASAE. But then when Wendy Jo and Don said, hey, we're starting a AANHPI advisory group. I was like, Darn, you're going to pull that card on me. You're going to say that you're one of the few CEOs who are of Asian descent. You need to join this. Like, okay, fine. And so thank you to Wendy and Don for starting that group. And so you can follow us on LinkedIn. We'll be launching here this month. So check us out. You can search up ASAE, AANHPI advisory group, and you'll find our activities there.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I know a lot of people are already looking forward to ASA annual meeting, and we can connect with you there and some of the other leaders of the AANHPI community at ASAE and in our profession. So I want to thank everybody again for joining us, especially my guest, Kanvu of SAIS. We have to go rogue for now. But we'll be back next week with another exciting episode. So don't forget to subscribe or follow us on your favorite podcast service. If you'd like to learn more about Rogue Tulips Consulting and how we can help your organization bloom outside the box, check out our brand new website. It's www.roguetulips.com. Check out our services page and our education page. And of course, don't forget to check out previous podcast episodes and our blog. So, on behalf of Con and myself, we'll see you next time.